It's as deliberate as placing a rock on top of a leaf. In order for placement to be successful, we have to formally acknowledge that we're letting go of concepts, thoughts, and emotions. Now I'm placing my mind upon the breath. What happens in that moment? Our attachments are uprooted. If we can even attempt such a thing, our discursiveness is greatly reduced. At the same time, by placing it on the breath, we're gathering that mind that's spread thin all over. For beginning meditators, the first stage is where we learn how to balance the focus on breathing, recognition of thoughts, and holding the posture. It's a grace period during which we develop good meditation habits. As we continue in our practice, placement is always the first step. It's that moment at the beginning of each session when we recognize and acknowledge that we've begun meditating. Because it establishes our attitude toward the rest of the session, it's the most important stage. The moment of placement gives our meditation a crisp, clean start. If we begin in a vague or ambiguous way, then our meditation will only continue to be vague and ambiguous. Like placing a domino, how carefully we place our mind in the first stage will directly affect the development of the next. After that first moment, each time you choose to recognize and acknowledge a thought and return your consciousness to the breath, you're learning placement. It's a small act, so innocuous, but it's one of the most courageous things you can do. When you recognize and release that thought, you can take pride in yourself. You've overcome laziness. You've remembered the instructions. You can feel happy coming back to the breath. Don't worry that you're going to have to do it again. You're going to have to do it thousands of times. That's why this is called practice. Each time you remember to place your mind on the breath, you're moving forward. Just by letting a thought go, you're extracting yourself from concepts, negative emotions, and bewilderment. You're letting go of the need to be endlessly entertained and consumed. You have to do it again and again and again. Change happens one breath at a time, one thought at a time. Each time you return to the breath, you're taking one step away from addiction to discursiveness and fear and one step forward on the path of enlightenment, beginning with developing compassion for yourself. I love golf. I play it whenever I can. No matter what kind of game I'm having, I can only hit one ball at a time. Each ball is the only ball. My mind has to be fresh each time. If I think of the balls I've hit or the balls I will hit, I'm not really hitting this ball. I'm only ingraining bad habits. It's the same with placement. If you're not crisp and fresh in recognizing and releasing thoughts, you're not really meditating. You're ingraining sloppiness. Those thoughts will gain power, and eventually you won't be meditating at all. You'll just be thinking. Recognizing, acknowledging, and releasing a thought is like reaching the top of a mountain. It's worthy of the warrior's cry, "Kiki, so-so!" What we celebrate is leaving behind the self-indulgent fantasies that will rob us of our life unless we work with them properly. Inspiration, view, effort, trust, mindfulness, and awareness support us in this. The more we're able to gather our attention and focus, the stronger our mind becomes, the stronger the experience becomes, and the stronger the result becomes. We know we're able to place our minds properly when we can hold our focus on the breathing for roughly 21 cycles without our mind becoming enormously distracted. 2. Continual placement. Placing our mind on the breath is now fairly easy. We've learned to mount the horse, and now we feel comfortable being in the saddle. The horse is walking along the trail. We're experiencing how it feels to be on the breath, to be continually in placement. When discursiveness and distraction takes us off the trail, by and large, we're able to implement placement to get back on. What allows us to do this is further development of mindfulness and awareness, lack of laziness, and remembering the instructions. Another reason we're able to successfully place our mind on the breath is that we have confidence in the reasons why we're meditating. We do it with enthusiasm because we know it will bring us peace. We see the futility of outside concerns, fantasies, thoughts, and emotions. We're willing to give them up at least for the period of our meditation because we see the benefits of doing so. Placement has become a reasonable thing to do. When resting our mind on the breathing and relating to our thoughts with ease becomes the norm, we're coming to the end of this stage. A benchmark is that we're able to rest our minds for roughly 108 cycles of the breath without being caught in distraction. Through 108 breaths, in and out, we can be mindful of the breathing. Although we may experience some discursiveness, the thoughts aren't bothersome or large enough that we lose mindfulness and forget the breathing altogether. At this stage, our mindfulness and stability last only so long. Then our mind drifts off. But when the mainstay of our practice is that we can stay on the breathing for 108 breaths, giving ourselves a little wiggle room in that we will be neither completely still nor completely distracted, then we've graduated from the second to the third stage, which is known as repeated placement. 3. Repeated placement. We might feel like we have been doing repeated placement since the beginning, but the landscape of meditation is vast, and the stages progressively subtle because they describe our experience, which becomes more and more refined. The Tibetan word for this stage is len, which means to retrieve, to gather, to bring back. We've learned how to place our mind and how to continue to place our mind, but occasionally a thought still breaks out like a wild horse galloping across the plains. In the first two stages, this happened incessantly. By the third stage, it happens only occasionally. During the second stage, we learn to enjoy the ride. We're delighted that we can stay in the saddle and enjoy the scenery. In the third stage, we become more confident. But the horse still has spontaneous moments of excitement and wildness. Now and then it rears or bucks or leaves the trail. We have to bring it back. We practice occasionally retrieving it throughout the third stage, and by the end we do it less and less. Our mindfulness is maturing into stability. Now we're able to focus on our breathing, on being present. When the mind departs, it's usually to chase fantasies of little pleasures, from food to better weather to romantic adventures. This is elation. We're holding our mind too tightly. We're focused on the breath so hard that the mind suddenly departs. As this stage progresses, the speed and efficiency with which we retrieve our mind increases. By comparison, the way we extracted ourselves from thoughts in earlier stages looks messy. Sometimes it was like quicksand. The harder we tried to get out, the more we were embroiled. But now, because mindfulness is so strong, we're able to remove ourselves with precision. By the end of this stage, we've achieved one of the milestones of shamatha, stability. Mindfulness is so potent that we're able to remain on the breath without ever being fully distracted. Awareness is also becoming more astute. We're beginning to catch thoughts before they occur. Our meditation isn't as clear and vibrant as it could be, but it feels good and peaceful because we've stabilized our minds. Throughout the course of a session, our mind always remains in the theater of meditation. This is an admirable accomplishment. In Tibet, it is likened to a vulture soaring high in the sky over a dead animal. The bird now always keeps its eye on the food. It may drift a little to the left or right, but it never loses sight of the food. Similarly, our minds may drift here and there, but never away from the breath. Before the end of the third stage, sometimes we were present for our practice and sometimes we weren't. Now we're there for all of it. This is stability. It didn't happen because we hit ourselves over the head with an overly simplified meditation technique. We achieved it gently and precisely through repetition, consistency, view, attitude, intention, proper posture, and good surroundings. 4. Close placement. The entry to the fourth stage, which is known as close placement, is marked by non-distraction. We always remain close to the breath. That's when we know we've crossed the border. This is stability. We know that even though the horse will wander here and there, it won't be leaving the trail. Our meditation now takes on a different twist. Previously, our main concern was not to be distracted from the breath. We were worried that our mind was going to be sucked back into everyday problems. We were always wondering if we'd be strong enough to return to the breath. Now we're more relaxed. We're no longer wondering if we can stay on the breath because we know we can. We're no longer concerned about outside influences pulling us away from meditation because we know they won't. Our confidence is heightened. Now we're concerned about the quality of our meditation, the texture, the experience. Before, we were worried that we couldn't get a cup of coffee. Now we want a mocha cappuccino. How can we make our minds stronger, more vibrant? This is our new priority. By and large, we've overcome the obstacles of laziness and forgetting the instructions. These obstacles were bad because they kept us from meditating. By the end of the third stage and into the fourth stage, we're dealing with the obstacles of elation and laxity. Either extreme has distracting results. However, since by now we're always remaining at the scene of our practice, these are considered good problems to have. In Tibet, we're warned that at the fourth stage, we might be fool enough to think that we've achieved enlightenment or high realization. The mind feels so strong and stable and good. Because the struggle with our mind has been reduced greatly, there's a quality of joy and ease. But if we enjoy the stability of the mind too much, it will become too relaxed. We might not reach the other stages. Hence the obstacle of laxity. Our mind is stable but not clear. The bird can't land on the meat, it can only fly around it. We need awareness to home in, sharpen sensibility, pull our mind in tighter. 5. Taming. Even though the accomplishments at the third and fourth stages are heroic, there's further to go. In the fifth stage, we're able to tighten up our meditation by bringing in more clarity. This stage is known as taming because we begin to experience the true fruits of a tamed mind, something that we began to cultivate long ago in the first stage. Taming here is the experience of lesu rungwa, being able to make our mind workable. In the fourth stage, we might still feel awed by the fact that we've tamed the horse, but now a strong, stable, and clear mind feels natural. Our mind is not perfectly still. We still have discursive thoughts. But we're feeling true synergy with the horse. We're feeling harmony. We're no longer struggling. The harmony and synergy create joy. A traditional metaphor for what we experience at this stage is the delight of a bee drawing nectar from a flower. Meditation tastes good, joyous. If you've ever had a hard time and then suddenly felt the pressure lift, you might have briefly known such bliss and liberation. 6. Pacifying. The sixth stage is known as pacifying. A great battle has taken place and there is victory. We're seated on the horse surveying the field. We know we've won. We feel tranquil and vibrant like mountain greenery after a thunderstorm. Everything has been watered and energized. There is tremendous clarity. We're still working with a mind that is sometimes tight and sometimes loose. In our practice, we still have to make many little adjustments. But in making these adjustments, we're no longer frantic, as we might have been in the first few stages. Then it was questionable that we would ever make our mind an ally. And now the peace we feel tells us that we have. Our meditation is joyous and clear. We begin to experience not only the mind's natural harmony, but also its inherent strength. At this stage, we also feel excitement. we begin to see the possibilities of what we can accomplish with our tamed mind. Before, this relationship was a burden. Now it's full of possibilities. The wild horse has been tamed. 7. Thoroughly pacifying. The battle may be over, but there are still a few little enemy soldiers running around in the form of subtle thoughts, mostly about pleasure. We may be slightly attached to how good meditation feels. There are little dualistic rumblings. Although we know that they're not going to disrupt our meditation, we can't just sit back and ignore them. In thoroughly pacifying, we don't dispel the thoughts as we did in stage 4. Now we seduce them, like snow falling into fire. Our meditation is becoming so strong that when thoughts and emotions encounter its heat, they naturally dissolve. Remember the waterfall of thoughts we felt when we first sat down on the cushion to tame our minds? It's become a lake, with only a few little ripples. 8. One-pointed. By the 8th stage, known as one-pointed, the remnants of discursiveness have evaporated. We're sitting there completely awake, clear, and knowing. This is possible because we're no longer distracted. Our meditation has developed all the attributes of perfection, which is what we will accomplish at the 9th stage. The only difference is that at the beginning of meditation, we still have to make a slight effort to point our mind in the direction of the breath. 9. Equanimity. Our meditation has come to perfection. When we sit down, we engage with the breath in a completely fluid and spontaneous manner. Our mind is strong, stable, clear, and joyous. We feel a complete sense of victory. We could meditate forever. Even in the back of our mind, there are no traces of thoughts. We're in union with the present moment. Our mind is at once peaceful and powerful, like a mountain. There's a sense of equanimity. This is perfection. Like a finely trained racehorse, our mind remains motionless but alive with energy. The mind has actually grown, in strength as well as size. We feel magnanimous, expansive. This is the fruition of peaceful abiding. Now we have a mind that is able to focus in any endeavor. We feel centered and confident. Part 3. Turning the mind into an ally. 12. Turning the mind. The power of peaceful abiding is that we begin to see how our mind works. We begin to see how our life works, too. That changes us. When we first began to practice, we might have felt as though thoughts and emotions were solid. Our minds were weak. Thoughts and emotions seemed overwhelming. Now we see that they're like mist rising from water. We see that thoughts are powerful because we believe in them, so much so that we base our entire life on them. How we dress, what we eat, where we live, and everything else about our life is a product of our thinking. What were we thinking when we bought this? What were we thinking when we did that? We begin to see how our belief in the solidity of thoughts has created this concept called me. We see that at the basis of our being is something deeper and more open than fantasies, emotions, and discursiveness. Now thoughts don't have the power over us that they did before. We're not distracted. Our mindfulness and awareness are keen. Through consistent practice, we've grown familiar with the feeling of a focused mind. We've developed the strength to stay with it. This state of clarity connects us with reality. Whether we're writing a master's thesis or cooking a meal, we're clear about who we are and what we're doing. We know our basic goodness. The mind's our ally, and we feel wholesome and complete. It's as if we've slept well and eaten well, and we're in good surroundings. We have a healthy sense of self. With a healthy sense of self, we feel at ease. Everything we need is already here. We're centered within a state of contentment. We're not too hard on ourselves. At the same time, we're wise to our own little tricks. We know how we get slippery. We know when we're trying to get away with something. We're comfortable looking at ourselves honestly. Our mind is open and supple. We're becoming inquisitive because a whole range of reality we hadn't noticed before is coming into focus. With this openness, flexibility, and curiosity, we begin to see certain truths about the way things are. The Buddha taught that to wake up from the dream of bewilderment and suffering, we first need to sit still and take a deep breath. Peaceful abiding is that deep breath, a way to strip away the chaos of bewilderment and find some basic sanity. But peaceful abiding is only the beginning of the spiritual journey. Simply withdrawing into the stability of our own minds could turn meditation practice into just another way to shop for pleasure. Instead, with this healthy sense of self, we can look more deeply into the meaning of our being. We can take meditation further by using insight, vipassana in Sanskrit, to reflect accurately on our own experiences and on the nature of existence. We can point our mind in a new direction, away from illusions and toward reality. We do this through the practice of contemplation. In a nutshell, the emotions we experience all come down to passion, aggression, and bewilderment. With peaceful abiding, we've been working mostly with seeing how we're either grasping what we want, passion, or pushing away what we don't want, aggression. This is like clearing the field of vines and thorn bushes. Now we have a stable mind that sees clearly the distractions of these two powerful forces and has the strength not to be swayed by them. What we're left with is the power of ignorance, and ignorance is the source of suffering. Ignorance is like a deeply rooted weed with runners. If we aren't aware of the pitfalls of delusion, how can we deal with them? We can dismantle our illusions by contemplating the reality of human life and our potential to awaken the mind of enlightenment. This is what we do in contemplative meditation. I've said that our bewildered mind is like a wild horse. I have a very high regard for horses. When I was in high school, I spent some time working on a ranch in West Texas. A stallion in the distance on the high plains is a powerful sight to behold. We don't tame such a strong, majestic creature by beating the spirit out of it. Instead, we work with its raw power and turn that energy in a certain direction. Where do we want to take that horse? Where do we want to go riding? We want to make a real journey. We want to ride in the meadows of compassion, the gardens of awakened heart, the fields of wisdom. This is the essence of the practice of contemplation. We learn to direct the energy of our mind toward enlightenment. When we practice shamatha, we gather the energy of the mind by drawing it in. We disempower bewilderment by recognizing and releasing thoughts and emotions. Initially, thoughts are a problem because we're so distracted by them. They're a problem when they build into strong emotions because they destabilize us. In contemplative meditation, we use them. Our object of meditation is no longer the breath. Instead, we hold our mind to a thought or a sentence and keep it there, and use insight to understand its meaning. This brings our concepts more in tune with reality. The Buddha was considered to be a renegade because he asked people to look in this way at the truth of what was going on. He left us clues about the nature of reality and how to encourage the mind of enlightenment. Precious human birth, impermanence, death, karma, samsara, and awakened heart or mind. What do these words really mean? How can we let them penetrate our being and allow us to transform? Contemplating the meaning of a particular thought moves us from concept toward a direct experience of reality, which is wisdom. We can say blue, but until we see the color blue, we don't really know what the meaning is. We can say that something is hot, but until we touch it, we don't know what hot means. We can talk about bringing our mind to compassion by saying, "May all sentient beings be free from suffering and the root of suffering." But until we feel the pain of others, pain is only a word. We have to crack its shell to let its meaning infuse us, seep into our lives. In contemplative meditation, we are getting to the inner essence of reality. After a certain point, the words fall away, but the meaning stays. We are no longer operating from the basis of concept. The subject-object separation is gone. The reality of birth, death, impermanence, and free and well-favored human birth has penetrated us. Just like the Buddha after he left the palace, we've incorporated their reality. We've picked the fruit off the tree and we can finally drink its juice. That's the point of contemplation. Hearing, listening, understanding. It puts us in tune with the nature of things. Seeing through ignorance and realizing the meaning of our lives is very precise work. Work for a mind that is stable, clear, and strong. It takes patience to do this practice. As my father used to say, it's like combing our hair over and over again. We're becoming familiar with thoughts that will shift the stream of our being, the direction of our lives, if we let their meaning penetrate us. In becoming familiar with love and compassion, karma and samsara, the preciousness of being human, the inevitability of death, we train in diving deep into the truth and awakening our dormant wisdom. Contemplative Meditation Instructions. Since having a stable mind is the ground of contemplation, begin your session with a few minutes of shamatha. Then shift your focus from the breath to a certain thought, inspiration, or intent. For example, you can say to yourself, "Now I am placing my mind on the preciousness of human birth," or "Now I am placing my mind on the reality of impermanence." Then gather the mind and place it on those words. Contemplation is peaceful abiding with a different object. So everything you've learned about shamatha applies to this practice. When you recognize that you're thinking about something besides the object of meditation, acknowledge that you're distracted and return to the thought you're contemplating. In this practice, the words are the gateway to the meaning. As you continue to place your mind on them, eventually the words fall away and their meaning or the experience to which they refer will arise. For example, you may start to feel your heart opening as you wish that your sister or your best friend be happy. In contemplating impermanence or death, you might feel a sense of groundlessness. By resting your mind in that meaning, that feeling, you're building familiarity with a particular facet of reality. At times you may find that you place your mind on the words and you don't really feel a thing. Just continue resting your mind on the words. As your own relationship with those words deepens, eventually an experience of their meaning will arise. It's sometimes necessary to really think about what you're doing. Return to the words as the object of meditation, and at the same time, bring in thoughts, images, and memories to enrich your contemplation. Sometimes I'll remember the beggars I've seen in India, for example, to help evoke a feeling of compassion. If you're practicing raising the mind of love, you can imagine people you know being really happy. This kind of focused and controlled thinking can crack the shell of the words and let the meaning come through. At the end of your session, let the meaning of your meditation become your view. For example, if you've been contemplating the preciousness of human birth, throughout the day you can let your mind rest in a sense of appreciation for life. You can be thoroughly soaked in the message of your contemplation. The topics in the following chapters are helpful to contemplate at some point in your practice. They will help you ground yourself in the realities of your life, appreciate what you have, and utilize your insight to go beyond the boundaries of me. You can also use these contemplations as antidotes if you're feeling a lack of courage or if you're feeling disheartened. They will give you inspiration. For example, when you feel that things are falling apart, you can contemplate the preciousness of human life to remind yourself of what you have. When you feel that you're making emotions and thoughts solid, you can contemplate impermanence to remind yourself that everything is in flux. When you're in the throes of an intense situation, you can contemplate the nature of samsara instead of feeling that you're completely to blame. When you're in the grips of anger or desire, it can be helpful to contemplate and dismantle the emotion according to the instruction given in Chapter 6. You can contemplate these topics at any time. First, do a little sitting, and then turn your mind to the contemplation of your choice for 10 minutes or so. At the end of the contemplation, sit for a few more minutes. Depending on your schedule and how the practice feels, do one topic a day, one a week, or even one a month. In an all-day session of practice, you could do one topic in the morning and another in the afternoon. For a summary of instructions for contemplative meditation, see Appendix C. 13. The joy of being human. In turning the mind into an ally, we are actively encouraging virtue, gewa in Tibetan. We can think of virtue as the qualities of an enlightened being, our enlightened genetic makeup. We are being courageous like a warrior in strengthening these positive aspects of ourselves. They include a stable mind, a healthy sense of self grounded in the experience of basic goodness, a clear view of the facts of life, an unconditionally loving heart, and the wisdom to know the right thing to do at all times. The mind of enlightenment sees things as they are. An enlightened being sees a non-compounded truth that is empty, joyous, and luminous, the basic nature of all. What the Buddha discovered on his journey is that we're all ultimately capable of seeing this truth and consciously rooting our activities in it. Our potential is to become totally happy. Perhaps we think of enlightenment as an instant transformation. One minute the Buddha was sitting under the tree, a regular Joe from India, and the next minute he woke up as Shakyamuni Buddha, the totally blessed one. However, it didn't happen like that. Enlightenment was the tail end of a long process. The Buddha was diligent in training and developing his mind. It took exertion, patience, and discipline to transform himself this way. Like spring bulbs dormant underneath the frozen earth, the qualities of the enlightened mind need time and the proper conditions to grow. Although surprising and revealing moments of insight may deepen our understanding, the mind of enlightenment doesn't open in an instant. These moments of insights are like the days getting warmer and longer at the end of winter. One warm sunny day isn't going to make the flowers bloom, but as more of them occur, we're going to see signs of stems and leaves and eventually buds. Just so, as our moments of insight accumulate, they begin to influence our activity. We're able to open our hearts. We begin to use what we've understood in contemplation to inspire our conduct in the world. The kind of insights we're going to have and our ability to know their meaning will depend on the strength of mind that we've already established. Most of us contemplate what's missing in our lives, as opposed to what we have. Contemplating what we have opens up our mind to be bigger, less insular. In contemplating the joy of being human, we focus on the words, joyful human birth, difficult to find, free and well-favored. When I was young, I used to entertain myself this way before falling asleep. In my mind's eye, I would see myself lying in bed. I would zoom back like a camera to include my house in my neighborhood in Boulder, in Colorado, in the United States of America, on the continent of North America. Then I would look at the planet like a globe, including India, where I was born, Tibet, where my father and mother were born, and Scotland, where I learned to speak English. Then I would picture Earth as a beautiful blue sphere floating in blackness. I would make the picture bigger, including other planets in our solar system with the sun in the center. The most amazing thing was to see Earth disappearing into the darkness as a speck. Then I would imagine the outer planets of the solar system. The sun would disappear as I imagined all the stars in our galaxy, which seemed endless. I would dissolve our galaxy into one star, one light, and make that light very tiny, surrounded by other lights in the darkness, which weren't stars but galaxies. Then I would think about how small I was, and how strange and wonderful it is to have been born. Everybody we know was born. Everybody we see was once a baby. First they weren't here, and then they were. We don't often contemplate birth. We're too busy worrying about money, food, the way we look, the way other people look, what other people are thinking about the way we look. But birth is a profound passage. Seeing a chick picking its way out of an egg is moving and powerful. Even though in being born we suffer, birth can happen in such love, such openness. And like death, birth shows us the fragility of life. Of all the hundreds of millions of stars and planets just within our own little Milky Way, this seems to be the only one that can support life. The scientific proof we have of life elsewhere is in amino acids and rocks, not even in animals, much less human beings. If we think about how many other kinds of beings are born here on Earth, it's amazing that we're born human. A traditional Buddhist teaching on the difficulty of obtaining human birth uses the image of a blind tortoise swimming in an ocean that's as big as the Earth, with an ox's yoke tossing on the surface. Once every 500 years, the turtle swims up to the surface. The chances of obtaining a human birth are said to be as small as the chances of that turtle emerging with its head in the yolk. We can think about how free we are in the human realm. The Buddha saw it as the place to be, because in this realm, if we're lucky, we can hear and practice spiritual teachings. We can discover our natural state and help others discover theirs. Even though beings in other realms still have the possibility of awakened mind, by and large, it's more difficult to cultivate. According to the Buddhist teachings, in some of these realms, beings don't even have bodies. In others, they think they have a body, but they don't. There are realms in which beings suffer too much to ever go beyond it. There are realms where they're constantly tortured by heat or cold or sharpness or wetness or dryness or brightness or darkness. There are realms where beings are totally consumed by jealousy or anger. There are realms where beings are always hungry. In other realms, beings don't experience enough suffering to investigate reality. They're having too much fun. These are godlike realms where beings live for a long time, but not forever. There's also the realm of animals, where ignorance rules. Here there's less possibility of realizing awakened mind because all energy goes into trying to stay alive. The habits of animals are pretty fascinating. When I watch a nature show on television, I wonder, do animals ever think about anything? If one beaver has a bigger tree to munch on, do the others get upset? In contemplating the human realm, we can think about how animals suffer, how they're used as beasts of burden, how we eat them, how they eat each other. It seems that most of their lives are territorial and chaotic. There's incredible aggression, struggle, and fear in the animal realm. If we go camping in a place where there are dangerous animals, we know how it feels to have to worry about being eaten. Well-favored means that we've been born in a time and place where we have the luxury of hearing, contemplating, and putting into action teachings that awaken us to our enlightened mind. We're relatively healthy. We have a roof over our heads and food in our mouths. We have family and friends. We've encountered someone who can teach us how to train our mind and open our heart. Being threatened by nuclear war, terrorism, and global warming is a reminder that we can't take such conditions for granted. We're just these tiny, vulnerable beings riding on a blue dot in space. Yet sometimes we act as if we're the center of the universe. The enlightened alternative is to appreciate how incredibly rare and precious human life is. The enlightened alternative is to appreciate everything. By appreciating whatever we encounter, we can use it to further our journey of warriorship. We are good as we are, and it is good as it is. Once we have this understanding, we'll see that we are living in a sacred world. As a result, we can be joyful. We may not be happy all day, every day, but we won't feel so sorry for ourselves. Through appreciating every aspect of human life, we can benefit others. When we're in good health, we can appreciate that. When we're ill, we can use the illness to awaken to the preciousness of our lives. We can appreciate the health that we have and feel compassion for others who are more ill. Even when we're very ill, we can be curious and courageous and use it as an opportunity to inspire others. When we're in any kind of pain, we can use it to open our hearts to the reality that people are always suffering. Pain is something everyone experiences. We can use it to ground us in the fundamental truth of our being. Pain gives us firsthand experience by which to be kind and generous to others. It gives us direct access through our empathy to helping others. We can use pain to activate compassion. We'd like others not to experience pain, and we can extend ourselves to them. We can contemplate the words, "May all beings be free of pain." Our direct experience of pain only makes our wish more potent. It may even decrease our pain because it increases our joy. This becomes a wonderful meditation. To sit there and contemplate the relief of pain and suffering of everyone, of the whole world. Not only because it changes our attitude toward our own pain, but also because it's opening our mind of enlightenment. This kind of prayer is always healing. If we're materially wealthy, we can appreciate the power it bestows on us to help others. If we're not wealthy, we can appreciate the simplicity and freedom of that. We can always contemplate and appreciate what we do have. In peaceful abiding, we have the means by which to tame our wild horse mind. In contemplation, we have a way to rouse the courage to direct our mind toward enlightenment. When we generate selfless love and compassion, we manifest tremendous power to help others find freedom from the bewildering and claustrophobic darkness of samsara. We are indeed well-favored. These are just a few thoughts we might contemplate to fully experience the meaning of our precious human birth. As we practice turning our mind toward an appreciation of our basic situation, we become less enmeshed in self-involvement. It becomes easier to tune in to the simple and ordinary pleasures of our existence. Our problems become smaller. Because we appreciate what we have, being alive seems fresh and good. 14. The unchanging truth of change. The face of impermanence is constantly showing itself. Why do we struggle to hide it? Why do we feed the circle of suffering by perpetuating the myth of permanence? Experiences, friends, relationships, possessions, knowledge. We work so hard to convince ourselves that they will last. When a cup breaks, or we forget something, or somebody dies, or the seasons change, we're surprised. We can't quite believe it's over. Most summers I conduct a program at a retreat center in the Rocky Mountains. We create a world of tents in a huge meadow. Dining tent, meditation tent, sleeping tents. It's refreshing to live like this, since most of us live in buildings all year round. At the beginning of the summer we put the tents up, and at the end we take them down. After the tents come down and we look into the meadow, we're always surprised. We feel happy and sad. We're happy in reflecting back on what occurred during the summer. We're sad that all the tents are gone. It seemed so real. No matter how many times we've done it, at the end of each summer we have the same feeling. This bittersweet taste marks our lives. The movie ends, our relationship's over, children grow up. Impermanence is always pounding at the door. Of course, acknowledging impermanence doesn't mean we get permanence. It means we're more in tune with reality. We can relax. As we relinquish our attachment to permanence, pain begins to diminish because we're no longer fooled. Accepting impermanence means that we spend less energy resisting reality. Our suffering has a more direct quality. We're no longer trying to avoid it. We see that impermanence is a river that runs through life, not a rock that stands in the way. We see that because we resist impermanence, pain and suffering are constants. We realize that pain comes from our desire for permanence. Contemplation helps us understand profound truths that we rarely consider, even though our life is contained by them. We contemplate these truths to bring about a shift in our understanding of reality, our perception of our life. When, during a meditation session, we hold our mind to the words, "Everything is impermanent," the meaning begins to come through. When we have a glimpse of impermanence, we hold our mind to that realization. In this way, we become familiar with a simple truth that we may have overlooked. We begin to live our lives with a deeper understanding. At this very instant, the weather is changing, our hair is growing, people are dying and being born, and the earth is shifting on its axis as it circles around the sun. We're growing older. Perhaps our mood has changed since yesterday. No matter how clear this may be to our intellect, we tend to put ourselves into a trance, thinking things are permanent. We're hypnotized into thinking the world is permanent, we're permanent, relationships are permanent, feelings are permanent. But all of it is impermanent. This contemplation brings us to a very basic level of understanding. It brings us back to the middle of the saddle. When I was 8, I flew from India to England. I had never been in an airplane before. As we began to land in London, looking down, I saw a world of tiny buildings, tiny streets, and tiny cars and trucks. This delighted me. I couldn't wait for the plane to land so that I could drive one of those little cars. But as we landed, that little world suddenly grew to adult proportions. It changed. The world is made of infinite moving parts. The mind produces a seeming continuity of events and ideas. What we call war is a series of calamities arising from beliefs and opinions, which are always subject to change. What we call peace is the absence of aggression, a tenuous state. When it is winter, summer no longer exists. We organize our life around the concept of a solid self in a solid world, even though all of it is simply ideas and forms coming in and out of existence, like thousands of stars flickering in the night. Is there anything that is not impermanent? In contemplating impermanence, we can consider what permanence would mean. Permanence would be awkward. It would be an unchanging situation, isolated in space, unaffected by time or the elements. There would be no beginning and no end, no causes and conditions. Everything would last forever. There'd be no seasons. We'd never be born, grow up, fall in love, have children, grow old, or die. We'd never eat because we'd never be hungry. We couldn't be in relationship to anything else because it would change us. In contemplating impermanence, we see the impossibility of life being anything other than what it is. We begin to lighten up and enjoy the constant play of light and dark, of visible and invisible, of increase and decrease. Contemplating impermanence can be a liberating experience, one that brings both sobriety and joy. In essence, we become less attached. We realize we can't really have anything. We have money and then it's gone. We have sadness and then it's gone. No matter how we want to cling to our loved ones, by nature, every relationship is a meeting and a parting. This doesn't mean we have less love. It means we have less fixation, less pain. It means we have more freedom and appreciation, because we can relax into the ebb and flow of life. Understanding the meaning of impermanence makes us less desperate people. It gives us dignity. We no longer grasp at pleasure, trying to squeeze out every last drop. We no longer consider pain something we should fear, deny, and avoid. We know that it will change. This is a very strong direction toward opening the mind of enlightenment. We've learned to look at what's in front of us. We don't have to keep imitating an idea of permanent happiness. If I work hard, I'm going to make a lot of money, and then I'll be happy. We see that happiness doesn't come about that way. It comes from cultivating the virtues that lead to enlightenment. Ultimately, it comes from wisdom, from understanding the unchanging truth of change. 15. First we get old. In a society as enamored of youth as ours, it is helpful to contemplate the process of aging. If we think about it and understand its place in our life, we can change our attitude toward aging. In this contemplation, we place our mind on the meaning of the words, "Aging is the nature of the human condition. I celebrate it." Birth is a painful and wonderful event. From that moment on, we age. As a child, we experience the pains of growing, of not knowing anything, of making friends in a newfound world. As an adolescent, we go through the pains of peer pressure and puberty. It all passes very quickly. When we're young, we want to be older. When we're older, perhaps we wish we were younger. During the Millennium celebrations, I watched a series of interviews with people who had lived for 100 years or more. Each of them was asked, "If you could relive any period of your life, when would it be?" Universally, they said it would be their 60s. At that age, they had maturity of mind, and at the same time, they still had a body that could do what they wanted. One of them had started running marathons in his 60s. Another had taken flying lessons. In terms of cultures, I straddle two worlds. In the West, we fret about aging. We feel old and we start acting old. In Tibet, people don't seem to worry as much about aging. When I hear my mother and her generation of Tibetans talk about getting old, the tone in their voice is proud. They're proud to have lived so long. They're cheerful. They have young minds. They're continuously curious, always learning. One of my favorite Tibetan sayings is, "Even if you're going to die tomorrow, you can learn something tonight." With this attitude, we don't feel as old. Once when I was driving home from the airport with my mother late at night, we passed McDonald's. I said, "That's the most famous restaurant in America." She said, "That one?" I explained that there are many McDonald's restaurants, and that many people don't approve of the food they serve. She said she wanted to give it a try. Since she mostly eats traditional Tibetan food, I didn't think she would like it. We took the drive-thru at McDonald's, which was a brand new experience for her. The whole process amazed her. I ordered her a burger, and as we drove away, she took her first bite. I asked her how she liked it. To my surprise and horror, she said, It's perfect. The meat is hot and the bread is soft. It turns out that she doesn't like many restaurants in America, but she loves McDonald's. In contemplating aging, perhaps we'll take a hint from our Tibetan friends and enjoy and appreciate growing old, as opposed to dreading it. We don't have to squeeze all the life out of our existence in an attempt to overcome the process of getting older. We can age with dignity. As we age, we're wiser, more experienced. We have more wisdom to offer others. We can maintain our health and vitality with the right activity, food, and most of all, curiosity about life. We can learn to celebrate the truth of aging without hiding in the shadows of denial and discursiveness. 16. And then we die. We spend most of our time avoiding death, not thinking about it. When we do, it gives us the shivers. We might feel slightly surprised, knocked off balance. We're afraid of death, partly because we don't know what will happen, partly because we're afraid of the pain we might feel when it happens. When we peek into the door of death by contemplating it, its meaning begins to penetrate us. Contemplating death gives us strength because it liberates our fear. So we contemplate the meaning of these words. Death is my friend, my truest of friends, for it is always waiting for me. All around us, life and death are performing a dance that brings texture to our existence. Death is our friend because it gives us life. Death defines life. If we didn't have death, we might not appreciate life. In every moment of our life, death is waiting for us. We're going to die. We don't know when we're going to die. We don't know how we're going to die. Everyone we know is going to die. Our parents, our friends, our children, our pets, people we like, people we don't like, kings and queens, heads of state, movie stars, rock stars, rich people, poor people, all have the same fate. This body will be a corpse. Without being morbid about it, whenever death presents itself, we can contemplate it. We can discuss it with our friends. If we come close to being hit by a bus, if we hurt ourselves in a car accident, if we get sick, we can ponder the permeable membrane between our life and our death. When someone close to us dies, we can look into death, question death, and let it transform us. What is death about? Why is this happening? Different traditions explain death in different ways. But when we experience the reality of death, it touches our life. It presents us with a deep mystery. Most of the time, we might rather not investigate it. When we're directly under its influence, we can be open to it, try to understand it. When I heard that my father was gravely ill, it just wouldn't sink in that he was probably going to die. He was a great meditation master and Buddhist teacher. After the Chinese invaded Tibet, he escaped on foot, leading 300 people over the mountains into India. He spent many years of his life planting the flower of Dharma on the rock of North America. He was a master warrior. If anyone could elude death, it seemed like it would be him. His death would leave a huge hole in my life, as well as the lives of many others. I was standing right next to him in the moment when he finally died. The space became very powerful and strong, almost luminous. There were no thoughts occurring. For days it was like that, as if reality had shifted. My whole life I had heard about death, had seen people who were dying and people who had died. But my father's death struck me in a different way. His mortality made me realize my own mortality. It made me realize everyone's mortality, It shook me out of my misconceptions. It profoundly changed my attitude. For many months, I thought about how I